Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Welcome in to another episode of Extension 720 here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Tonight, what's old is new. We bring you stories that compare and contrast, a constant tug of war that is old versus new. Each one of our segments tonight touch upon that theme in one way or another. For instance, in Chicago's runoff, several old guard aldermen are facing serious challenges from new look candidates. We'll look at three specific races where the results on Tuesday could go a long way to understanding what kind of city council we may have for the next 4 years. On our Download on Chicago Business segment, we give you a different perspective on development. Last week, we heard from those who wanted to slow down mega projects like Lincoln Yards or the 78. But my guest tonight says that Chicago needs the new and that we're in danger of destroying progress. We'll talk with the Association of General Contractors coming up after the 7:30 news. Composer Alan Menken knows a thing or two about the new and the old. Menken is a musical legend, from off-Broadway hits like Little Shop of Horrors to the Disney Renaissance films like The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast. Menken has been at the cutting edge and serves as nostalgia for several different generations. We talked to him about his career and his music and emotion. He's singing his songs at the Auditorium Theater tomorrow night. And a twofer on the neighborhood tour. Tonight we hit up Bucktown and Andersonville, two Northside Chicago neighborhoods that embody out with the old and in with the new. Eitan Mihaly talks to us at the Roby Hotel in Bucktown, and Abby McEnany invites us to Collectivo Coffee on Clark Street. It's a brand new show, Extension 720. Stay with us. A quick thought on our theme tonight, old versus new. It's as simple as time. But it seems like sometimes we trick ourselves that it's that simple. Because you can make the argument that what's new is old and what's old is new, and the cycle continues. We constantly grapple with this concept. It's almost in everything we do in our life. How many times have you said today, man, they don't make them like they used to? Or bemoan the fact that the new and improved isn't as good as the tried and true? And how many times have you complained that someone's stuck in their old ways, or that something is stale, or so yesterday? It's everywhere. Oh, to be young again. He's an old spirit. She's young at heart. Old town, new city, old style, new Belgium, old spice, new Coke. And so on and so forth. It's a huge part of our daily lives. We define ourselves through this lens, for better or for worse. And of course, that means corporations and the powers that be try to manipulate us, to sell products or make something relevant. Even the news centers around this theme. New progressive campaign versus old machine politics. We honor anniversaries. Did you see that The Matrix turned 20 today? Man, I remember when that film came out. I'm so old. We point out the new. Architect Jeannie Gang is going to redesign the old O'Hare Terminal. In sports, the new look White Sox are rebuilding. And the GOAT, the old-timer, Tom Brady, turns back time. But I'm not sure any of this matters to us. Because when in balance, all of us are a little old and a little new. I could go on and on and on. And that's the point. It's a concept that is as old as time. So maybe it's time for something new.
Oh,
versus new tonight in Extension 720. We got a big show lined up, so let's take our break now so we can get to all the content. Cram it in tonight on this Friday here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. It is Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. This election on Tuesday will definitely usher in a new moment in Chicago politics. A progressive Democrat will be elected mayor. But as all eyes focus on who will take over the fifth floor, another big moment is happening a couple floors down. With 15 aldermanic races in question, the new mayor may have a new look city council, a council that may be younger and more progressive than ever before. So is that a good thing for Chicago? Are younger candidates riding the wave of change, or will current aldermen be able to point to their records, their experience in their own neighborhoods to win re-election? Let's examine, shall we? We picked three races from the runoff that feature old guard aldermen taking on first-time challengers. These races will go a long way in understanding which direction Chicago wants to go. The traffic flows on the 5500 block of West Belmont Avenue just before Central. This is Belmont Cragen, and it's a big part of the 30th Ward. The 30th Ward has been a Latino power center for years, represented by Alderman Ariel Reboyras. He faced little opposition over the years due to his alliances with powerful former Congressman Luis Gutierrez. But not anymore. A new Gutierrez has jumped into this race. Jessica Gutierrez is the daughter of Luis, and she's pushing Reboyras for change.
We need new leadership. We need a bold voice. We need a fierce voice that's going to go downtown. We need someone who isn't going to rely on the residents to make the complaints, who's going to create a community which we can all work together to see where the problems and the holes are, literally, like figuratively and literally, right?
As a progressive candidate here in the 30th Ward, you almost straddle two areas. One, which is you are a new face and a newcomer, but you have an old name, an old political, powerful name in Gutierrez. What have you learned about being in a political family that helps you run for this kind of office?
I'm so grateful that I have my mom and my dad, you know, that have, they have seen some really dark days in Chicago, right? I mean, before I was born, this was Beirut on the Lake. You know, I always thought that was a great name to give it, right? And it was very true. That's what they've lived. In terms of values, I think the biggest one that I've learned is that sometimes you're even going to have to speak out against your allies and your friends. That if your allies and your friends are doing wrong by your community, you have to step up and say no. My father was a friend of our former President Barack Obama, but when he became the deporter in chief, right? When he deported the most amount of immigrants from our country, my dad stepped up and he had to step up to his friend, and he got arrested in front of the White House. Multiple times,
and
right?
Not to mention the current mayor of Chicago as well, right?
Exactly. And, you know, what I see in our alderman is someone who is the yes man to the fifth floor. And he has not been able to understand that sometimes you need to say no to your friends and your allies to help your community gain. And if you're not willing to do that, then you're not a leader. And it's time to step aside because there's great new leadership in Chicago.
A few blocks south at Diversity and Central, Alderman Reboyras surveys his block, pointing out the changes since he's taken office.
I've been here 32 years. When I first came in here, there were probably two other Hispanic families. The first, second, third, fifth house down where the pine tree is. One, and then across the street. They're still here, 2655. And us, primarily Polish, 90% of it. Polish.
Reboyras is salty about this year's election, feeling that his old allies have stabbed him in the back. He says he's all for change, but there's a right way to go about it.
Very close to Congressman Gutierrez. I would help him out every 2 years, get the signatures. I personally will go out with him. I was shocked when this happened. I think it's important that the youth want to be part of a community, but the style and the way they did it was a little, you know, it's very difficult to take in. But, you know, everyone has a right to run, and that's what he said. You know, and basically what I said, yeah, that's great. Well, you know, maybe my opponent could come and join me and learn how we do this. And maybe, just maybe, that if I think that you're really interested, you learned how to operate here, and maybe it's a good time to say, here, about time a young person can take it over, but it didn't happen that way.
We head east towards the lake to a tree-lined street north of Foster in Ravenswood / West Andersonville. This is home of the 40th Ward, a ward that's been run by Alderman Pat O'Connor for over 35 years. The alderman has spent most of his career running unopposed. But this year, a new face is challenging the machine. His name is Andre Vasquez. He's not really a politician, more of a community activist. A former Chicago hip-hop artist, Vasquez is running a very grassroots campaign with a platform of change. The current alderman is taking Vasquez very seriously. He's amassed a campaign war chest of $780,000. That's a lot of money for the mayor's council floor leader. Vasquez knows it's an uphill battle, but he's confident in his message.
It's extremely hard, not necessarily for the name recognition, because that goes both ways, right? There's people who know the name and aren't pleased. But when you have that long of time in government, the amount of connections and people that actually have access to larger amounts of money helps you be a stronger candidate, right? So I think, you know, part of our campaign is pushing forward a fair elections ordinance, which would set up publicly financed small donor matching systems so people could actually run and have a healthy competitive democracy. I think what helps us is more the time we're at in the city, where everyone recognizes that the last 3 to 4 decades of government have taken us in a direction that doesn't help us out, and that we need to change course. And you can't trust somebody who's benefited from a corrupt system for that long to be the person to do it.
You have had quite a career. You've done a lot. People know you in Chicago as an underground hip-hop artist. You've been all around the city. How do you take the lessons you learned from that work and apply it to this work, trying to be the 40th Ward Alderman?
Sure. I mean, you know, some of it, it's all been an evolution, right? Because clearly there are things that plague hip-hop as far as toxic masculinity, homophobia, misogyny, right? So having to really look and pick that apart helped me out currently. When I was a hip-hop artist, because I had to travel all around the city, I was able to see the difference in investment, right? Why the South and the West Side are completely different from the North Side. You understand how segregated the city is, how differently you're treated as a person of color, and really the lack of resources. So I think that at root, that sort of injustice is kind of what brought me to hip-hop, because you had artists such as like Public Enemy and KRS-One that clearly talk about that stuff.
How does it feel to be a part of a movement in Chicago that seems like younger people are being taken seriously?
It feels awesome. You know, at the federal level, we kept trying to get a blue wave to happen. I think in Chicago, seeing this progressive wave occur is extremely heartening. I think the potential to have a larger coalition, right, to have a progressive caucus, to have a Democratic Socialist caucus, to be potentially part of the Latino caucus. I've been throwing the term around that I asked my wife if she thought it was cool, to like call myself a coalitionist, right, to really focus on the fact that it's not one group, but really building that coalition like Harold Washington did to move all of us forward. And I think it's just an amazing opportunity for the city going forward.
And turning to the South Side, the 5th Ward is locked in a runoff battle. The current alderman, Leslie Hairston, has been leading South Shore and Hyde Park since the 90s. She's proud of her service, proud of her accomplishments. She points to a need for experience, a need for connection to lead the 5th Ward.
I have managed over my time to do a lot of things that people really don't recognize that I did. You know, when I took office, there was no median on Stony Island. It was just go for yourself. I put the grass and the medians there. I actually put the underpasses on access to the lake at 57th Street, 63rd Street, 55th Street. I mean, you have to make sure that people have safe neighborhoods, and you have to look at your arterial streets as the places to do that. I mean, some of the things that I did was create an SSA, SSA number 42, which you see the banners and everything, but also we pay an additional security company on 71st Street to kind of manage it. And, you know, we also have Operation Clean Slate, or Clean Street now. They changed their name to, you know, help with the trash on the boulevards, you know, to make sure that we look like we want to look. I mean, it's a constant effort. 53rd Street didn't always look like it looks now. It's taken 20 years for it to get that way. You know, but you have to keep moving forward, and you have to keep trying different things.
Okay, so 71st Street, as we stand on 71st Street, just a couple blocks down, you have the Shop and Save, which is coming in, and the old Dominick's.
Yes.
This has been a big point of contention in this
huge,
ward, because you've been without a grocery store for years.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, when Dominick's decided that they were closing all their stores, and this is the hardest thing for people to understand, and it's also pretty offensive because what corporate America, the corporations that have grocery stores say is that you're not important enough to eat. As if we don't have the need to eat every day. And so it has been a constant challenge for me to find a grocery store because the regular corporate stores did not want to come into this location. Mm-hmm. So I had to use personal relationships like that I've built over the years, like I had to do when I got the Starbucks on Stony Island.
You know, you are a part of the Progressive Caucus.
Yes.
You know, a mixed bag in the election. You had some that that members who were outright beaten in their wards. You have some that are in runoffs like yourself.
Yes.
Some ran on opposed, of course, but is the Progressive Caucus, as more people talk about the new city council that will be coming up here in May, is it still the old Progressive Caucus, or are we going to see something new?
Well, I don't know what that looks like, but, you know, I have always been a member of the Progressive Caucus since taking office, and, you know, it would be nice to have some extra bodies to help push the agendas that we have been trying to push that a lot of people say now, but, you know, I also remember 4 years ago, everybody was, you know, for change and change and change, and they got there, and guess what? They didn't become members of the Progressive Caucus. They were not voting on progressive issues in the way that they should be. So, you know, it's always interesting.
But Alderman Hairston's finding quite a challenge from upstart community activist Will Calloway. Calloway made himself known to Chicago when he led the protests against the city and the Chicago police over the Laquan McDonald shooting. Calloway is running a campaign focused on gun violence, police reform, and the ward's poverty issues. He's not taking money from corporate interests and feels that the 5th Ward and the city of Chicago need new, young leadership.
This intersection on 71st and Shapiro, where my campaign office has in the past 2 years have saw three homicides and 10 different shootings. One was just right in front of my campaign office. A young man was shot two times. He survived. And then we're also steps away. We're about 100 feet away from where Haritha Augustus was shot by Chicago Police Department last summer. As we all know, that turned into a violent protest with law enforcement and community members. So community policing is my second issue that I want to address. And also, we're about 100 yards away from the vacant Dominick's and resolving the food desert, and not just with this Shop and Save, but with a real full-service grocery store is be my third issue that I want to address.
You kind of made your candidacy known from the podium right after the verdict came down in the Jason Van Dyke trial and the killing of Laquan McDonald. But you talked about a need for more elected officials or accountability from elected officials, and here you are.
We have to be the change agents that we seek, right? And I want to be that change agent. I want to go down to city council. I want to bring the policies and introduce policies and ordinances that's important to my community, right? To my 5th Ward constituents. And also, I want to hold my colleagues accountable. And that's something that we do not see. We don't see we don't see the aldermen down there holding their colleagues accountable. And even as a person of color, we're really discouraged because we feel that we do not have a legitimate voice of in the Black Caucus to represent us and represent our issues. As a person of color, as a millennial, there's nobody down there speaking on my behalf. And that's what frustrates a lot of voters, especially young people, because nobody is speaking up for us on the issues that's what we really care about. And I want to be that voice in city council.
Whatever happens on Tuesday, these races will go a long way in charting a course for the next 4 years of Chicago politics and define what kind of city council the new mayor will be working with. Quick notes, Alderman O'Connor in the 40th Ward did not respond for comments. I wanted to include him in peace, but did not get back. Also, this coming Tuesday, election night returns at the Billy Goat Tavern. With myself and Andrea Darlis, we're going to be hosting Election Night Returns. It's open to the public. Come on out. Have a double cheeseburger and a beer underneath Lower Michigan Avenue for a traditional Chicago celebration of the election returns and results as we pick a new mayor.
It's going to be a lot of fun, Justin.
It's going to be so much fun.
People are already texting saying they're going to be out there. And actually, someone said they were going for a triple cheeseburger. No fried chips, no Pepsi Coke. So, yeah, I'm super psyched about being out there.
How great is that? It's a fun thing to get out and to do it outside of the studio, but also just the excitement of election night. Not just the mayor's race, but these aldermanic races are going to be pretty tight.
Absolutely, and I love the preview stories that that you've been doing, too, as well, you know, because it feels like we're out there, you know, and dealing with some of these issues and hearing some of the issues firsthand from the aldermen embroiled in these races. It's going to be a great night.
Yeah, it is. And some more neighborhood conversations coming up later in the hour.
It's business time.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it's time for the Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. And sticking with our theme tonight, let's talk about the relationship with the old and the new when it comes to Chicago development. There's been a lot made of the mega projects on their way to Chicago and how they may remake the city. Developments like Lincoln Yards and the North Branch of the Chicago River have come under fire from politicians and protesters alike. And now many are asking the same questions about the proposed development along the South Branch of the Chicago River, the 78. But Chicago is not a city that has a history of waiting for change. It moves forward. As Chicago city planner Daniel Burnham famously said, make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood. But I'm not sure that Burnham was tasked with figuring out how traffic was going to get across the North Avenue Bridge. Well, that's another story. But is there a cost to Chicago slowing down or delaying these major projects? The Chicagoland Association of General Contractors believes so. The executive director, Dan McLaughlin, penned a letter to the Chicago Tribune earlier this month talking about this very subject, and he joins me tonight. Dan, thanks for being here.
How you doing?
Good, good. You know, a week ago I had people on to talk about delaying development, transparency, this right. idea that we're moving too fast in these mega developments, specifically with Lincoln Yards. But in your letter, you had a different take on this, that slowing down is actually can have detriment to our economy. Explain.
Well, I think it can, but I also want to say I don't know that this is moving all as fast as everybody thinks. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes with the planning department, the planning staff of the city, long before it starts the public hearing process and public meetings. So there's a lot of work going on for a long time before the
right,
public
right.
sees it. So, and the staff does their job. They know what the neighborhoods need. They know how city Chicago, what the demands are and that. So they try and work those out, some of those ideas out with the developers before it gets to a relatively final plan. But I do think, I think delaying has the potential to lose some of these big projects. When you have a major delay, you're taking a couple of chances. First of all, the economy has been very strong for a long time. Everybody knows and expects there's going to be a correction in the economy. Next year, the year after, we don't know. But at some point, there's going to be a correction in the economy where things slow down. Money becomes hard to borrow, or money becomes so expensive that some projects right. will all of a sudden won't work. The other problem is major delays. And the developers have the potential of losing some of the commercial tenants that they were courting and expected
putting
to put
together right.
developments. So there's a lot of things you have to think about. I get the idea of at least making sure, slowing down enough to make sure you get everything right, but I think that's what the planning department and planning staff does real well behind the scenes in the early stages.
And you representing the Association of General Contractors, you also look at the economic indicators when it comes to jobs. There are so many jobs that are available for people who are going to be on the site and be able to work on these projects.
Right. Well, the projects like Lincoln Yards you're talking about, 78, those will produce thousands and thousands of jobs and hundreds of contractors, work for hundreds of contractors. So they're very valuable for the economy. In Chicago, but I would say a lot of people at least in the business, you hear people talking about counting cranes downtown, and I think in the last few years there's been an average of about 45 or 50 cranes working at any one time, and that's a good indication that the economy's good, a lot of construction's going on, but those cranes for the last few years don't touch or don't take into account Lincoln Yards, which is a $5 to $6 billion project. 78 is a $6 to $7 billion project. O'Hare expansion's $8.5 billion.
Those are all on the way.
They're on the way.
Right.
They're on the way. You got the improvements for the Cook County Hospital. You got the Obama Library. There's a lot of work coming up. So But that's good. It's good for the economy. It's good for producing jobs. It's something that we're in a unique position right now, and it's a very positive position. And a lot of major delays could really affect that.
Dan, I've talked about this before on the Download in Chicago Business, talking about the need for more skilled work. General contractors will tell you, if you go talk to them, they'll say, I'm up to my eyeballs. It's not like it was 10 years ago where people were looking for any odd job they could pick up. There are a lot, and a lot of construction firms and general contracting firms that just don't have the manpower.
Absolutely.
How do you recruit? How do you deal when you have 40-some-odd cranes up in the air and $6 billion projects waiting to come next? Yeah. How do you see you can't recruit fast enough?
And that there's something to that. But there's a couple other factors. I want to reinforce what you just said. There is a huge demand for jobs right now because of construction so good. But nationally, too, the AGC reported, the Department of Labor reported just recently, there's 88,000 plus job openings in the construction industry, the most of any particular industry.
Wow.
But there's the idea of trying to recruit people for that. The apprentice schools for all the different trades, plumbers, carpenters, electricians, all the different trades are constantly running apprentice programs, and they've been adding more classes and taking on more apprentices lately to try and do that. We're also kind of spearheading a program, or trying to put together a program with the developers, labor, mm-hmm. the community, to try and increase the number of minorities in construction as well. So there's kind of two things. We need bodies.
We need bodies.
We need more workers because there's a demand. And I'll also add that about half the industry is over 49, which means in the next 10 years, while all these big projects are coming on,
right.
a lot of retirements are taking place.
It seems to me, too, that when you're talking about the number of jobs, when you're talking about 88,000 jobs that are open, and you need to find skilled...
That's nationally.
Nationally.
Right.
But you need to find skilled workers to fill those roles. The old ways of apprenticeships and the old ways of recruiting and trying to get bodies to do this kind of work, does there have to be a wholesale change? Because we've seen trade schools at the public school level kind of go away and dissipate, and less of an investment across the board from municipalities when it comes to skilled workers. They've gone into higher education instead. Does there need to be a wholesale change at the government, both federal and local, to think, you know what, there are so many jobs that are open, we need to start investing more money into trade schools and trade programs to help with the AGCs and the others that are trying to get these things done?
Well, that is true. And the city of Chicago, Mayor Rahm Emanuel has worked on a few programs with a couple of the local high schools and making them more encouraging trades mm-hmm. for the high school students. But there's also several organizations like Cisco. I'm on the board of Cisco, and their main function is to go out to all the high schools and talk to kids about the opportunities in construction and what kind of jobs are out there, the benefits, all that. And I'm guilty of it, too. I have four kids and wanted to see them go to college. But there are people out there that maybe aren't interested in going to college, would rather start working with their hands and making money right away.
Mm-hmm.
And those people have to know where the opportunities are. So I think a big part of the burden is on the industry to get the word out on where do you go for
to get that done,
to get the information for those jobs. We started the Chicago Associated General Contractors started a few years ago a website called buildillinois.com, and that's the main purpose of buildillinois.com, is for students or young adults to be able to go on that website and learn about all the different trades that are out there, and how do you make contact with the apprentice schools, how do you get into the industry. So that website is a good starting point for
right.
a lot of people. We also put a series of posters out and sent them to all the high schools and junior colleges to kind of drive kids to that. Now, we're not trying to discourage anybody from going to college. We just want the ones, the students that are thinking they may or may not want to go to college, at least know there's another option out there. And it's a good option. These aren't just jobs. These are careers with benefits.
Yeah, obviously. And because you have seen for the last decade 40 some odd cranes up at any given time. We're not talking about 40, just counting them right now. And wow, this is a record. This is a consistent construction boom right now in Chicago.
Well, it has been for a few years. But you go back to the 2010 recession, and you know the industry kind of had a triple whammy. You get the economy tanked, and there wasn't enough work for people. So the people that could retire retired.
Right.
Other people couldn't find enough work, so they went into a different field altogether and didn't return. And the third thing was the apprentice schools, a lot of them cut back on their classes or even stopped for a year or two. So that 2010-2011 period really was took a hit on the industry.
Let me ask you about minority hiring, because you'll see a lot of stories pop up in the news when it comes to projects that are in minority neighborhoods. So you'll see the Obama Presidential Center in Jackson Park, or you'll see the extension of the Red Line 95th Street. But there seems to be a desire for communities to hire their own, and that seems like a very normal concept.
Absolutely.
Right? So does when you're at the association and otherwise, do you subscribe to that notion that
absolutely
minority hiring should be in the neighborhoods that they come from?
Yeah, every, you know, when you deal with the general contractors that I deal with, the bigger contractors, they all have their own program to try and recruit minorities. And there's probably 50 or 60 different neighborhood organizations and churches that all try and take kids and teach them some pre-apprentice skills and job skills, and then try and get them into either jobs or apprentice programs. So there's all kinds of programs out there, just maybe not as coordinated as it should be, and a lot of times people don't know where to go to get into those programs.
Right.
So we're trying to help coordinate some of that, and we're working with the Chicago Federation of Labor and some of the other labor organizations that are working with us and the developers. It's kind of unique right now because the developers, the labor leaders, the contractors, and the neighborhood representatives are talking more and more now than they ever have. So that's a good thing, and hopefully we'll have some positive results soon.
Okay, so here, the theme tonight, the theme of the show is old versus new, or out with the old and with the new. When I think of development and I think of contract, that kind of part and parcel to the whole concept. Chicago is a place that has on the surface this reputation of getting rid of its history. Looking at a building and saying, you know what, we could build a better condo, tear it down, put it up. And that's great for jobs, and that's great for general contractors, I'm sure, all the way through. But it does feel that we are less connected to our history than, say, some of the cities on the East Coast. Do you see it that way from your perch? I mean, obviously you have a vested interest because you like, your association likes to build stuff. But the concept that, do you see Chicago being a tear down city?
I don't. I mean, I think there's enough historic buildings that I'm a history nut. I'm a Chicago history nut at that. So I like to see all the old buildings stay. And I got to give credit to Mrs. Daly a number of years ago that actually fought to keep the old library on Michigan Avenue from being torn down. That's a great building. But I think the historic preservation groups that are out there do a pretty good job of identifying buildings to save, and then some just aren't worth it saving. So they'll be more useful. The property will be more useful,
right,
providing jobs and providing new residences or commercial spaces. So, but I think the city does a pretty good job. I mean, Boston's got a different history than Chicago, going back obviously to the beginning of the country. So they have a lot more historic buildings that are worth saving. But I think my times in New York, I think New York is a lot like Chicago. You know, if the building isn't really historic, then there's an opportunity here to build something new and better.
Dan McLaughlin is the executive director of the Chicagoland Association of General Contractors. He's in studio tonight, my guest on the Download in Chicago Business. Dan, thanks for coming by and
appreciate
sharing
it.
Your story. I appreciate
it. Thanks.
Back to Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
If you want to get in a conversation about new and old, your thoughts about that old saw. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight, we're going to continue our neighborhood tour. Last night, we were accidentally preempted by the Chicago White Sox. The Sox game was rain delayed. So it started late. You all know this, White Sox fans. So we were supposed to be on the air right before the Blackhawks game started. Of course, the pregame, I think, was at 9 o'clock. Anyway, my point being that we had a Chicago neighborhood tour lined up for last night. We were going to go to Bucktown with Eitan McKaylee, and we weren't able to air that. So tonight, a twofer. We're going to do that Bucktown conversation, and we're also going to do the one we had planned tonight with Abby McEnany in Andersonville. So we will talk about the issues in Bucktown Wicker Park, which is talk about the new and the old. I stood in front of where we had the conversation at the Roby Hotel, the cafe in the Roby Hotel, which right away, you're like, what is happening here? And we took the picture in front of the old Mad Bar, which is now a Nike store. So if you want to talk about the new and the old, Bucktown's a perfect place. And we talked with Abby McEnany in Andersonville about the changes up on that north side neighborhood. So that's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, right after the news, I'm so excited about this. Alan Menken. Alan Menken is a composer, singer-songwriter, a legend, and a capital L legend. I don't just throw that word around. He's a Disney legend. That's a thing. It's like their Walk of Fame. They have stars at the, you know, that they put into the sidewalk. That's a Disney legend, and Alan Menken is a star. He, of course, is the man behind so many iconic Disney films. It's crazy if you look at his canon of work. All the way up to this weekend, I was watching Wreck-It Ralph Wrecks the Internet. I know, classic. Real strong $5.99 choice for my Comcast. But Alan Menken's name is on the back end. He started his first film with The Little Mermaid. He then followed it up with Beauty and the Beast. Then Aladdin. Strong all the way through the 90s. He and his partner, Howard Ashman, were credited with the Disney Renaissance. Because up to that point, Disney hadn't had the success they had had with Snow White and Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, those classics. That was a different time. They were looking to remake their brand. So they turned to Howard and Alan, and they created some of the most iconic music in musical film history. Continues to be. Under the Sea. Right away, Be Our Guest for Beauty and the Beast. A whole New World, which is Aladdin. There's amazing. You can just keep going.
I love all these songs.
Yeah,
As soon as you say this song, Justin, I'm going a whole new what in my off key singing voice.
It's and also that Alan and Howard Ashman, they did Little Shop of Horrors on Off Broadway,
yeah,
which started that and turned that into a movie, and of course began their illustrious career. So we'll talk with Alan Menken, who's going to be at the Auditorium Theater tomorrow night. He's doing one of these shows where he sings the songs and he talks and tells stories, which this is amazing. You're right, Andre. I when I started looking into this and getting ready for this interview, I was blown away at all of the work that Alan Menken has done. It's every song. They say he is the melody maker in Hollywood.
Absolutely. Every song you've said, someone has to know at least one or two. At least.
And think about all the generations. I mean, even today, 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds are singing Under the Sea. They're being entertained by Alan Menken's work. It's pretty impressive. And Alan Menken is coming up next here on Extension 720. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tomorrow night, the famed Auditorium Theater will play host to composer and Disney legend Alan Menken. He's bringing his show A Whole New World of Alan Menken to the stage to tell stories and sing songs from his brilliant career. And brilliant career may be an understatement. The musician has won 8 Oscars, 11 Grammys, and a Tony thrown in for good measure. Menken has been behind some of the best music scores and songs in movie and stage history. Little Shop of Horrors, The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, just to name very few. Menken, along with his late creative partner Howard Ashman, are responsible for the Disney Renaissance of the late 80s. He worked on a new Aladdin with Will Smith, which is coming to theaters this summer. My pleasure to welcome Alan Menken to Extension 720. Great to have you. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Where does a show like this come from? I mean, is this a tour? Is this something that you have put together? Because it seems a little bit out of character for you.
Well, you know, the impetus for this was that my career gets so compartmentalized. You know, there'll be like an evening of Disney music, which will feature a lot of my work plus others. Or there'll be an evening where someone will do Little Shop of Horrors, or there'll be a right. Christmas Carol, or there'll be, you know, the sister act. I said, I'd like to have some way to bring it all together in one performance, and also to share stories, the background to the songs. And so I have these 3 screens that have, you know, images on them or information or even a video. And I play sometimes whole songs, sometimes snippets of songs, talk about what led to a project, what came from it, what the feelings were, the emotions, and just share it with an audience.
It's amazing, too, because you have been behind the scenes when it comes to music as a composer and as a musician
for so many years. But you started off as a musician, you know, who's on stage and on mic, coming full circle and coming back to that style. Yeah. You know, is that important to you?
Not as a, it's not like, you know, the part of me that wanted to be a singer-songwriter when I was a very young man is looking for this as that kind of release. It's not that. It's just a nice way for me to connect with audiences, a nice way for me to bring my career as an entity into its own arena.
Mm-hmm.
And there aren't a lot of spaces to do that. There's occasionally an evening of Alan Menken's music, whatever, which is great. What I like about this is I have the freedom to do whatever I want on the stage. There's a structure to it, but, you know, I can go on some tangents. I can just talk to the audience. And there's a, you know, I've become aware that there's a big audience out there of people who are really affected by this and love it. And, you know, it's nice to once in a while get out there and be in touch with that.
And we could take one aspect of your career, just as you mentioned about these shows, and spend an hour on The Little Mermaid. We could spend an hour on Little Shop of Horrors. I was fascinated reading about your story, about your early days in New York City, and the decision for you to go all in as a composer, as a musician, to not be someone who does one thing on the side or another and do dabble with music. You made a choice at an early point in your life that you wanted to do this work. Take us there. Take us to that moment in the mid to late 70s, New York City.
Yeah, it was in the early 70s. You know, I was in college. I loved music. I felt in my gut that I am a composer, and I always composed, but I came from a family where, frankly, all the men were dentists. We're lousy with dentists. My grandfather was a dentist. My father was a dentist. My father's brother was an orthodontist. My mother's sister's husband. It's just, I could go on and on with the dentists. And clearly, I did not really want to be a dentist, nor did I really have the aptitude for that. And now, as a kid, I was very ADD. I hated to practice. So I was like one of those 60s kids that, you know, when early 60s came and the Beatles and Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones and all, you know, that really energized me. Prior to that, I had a background in classical music, and I grew up in a family that loved musical theater. So at a certain point, as I was graduating from college, I go, what am I going to do? I don't want to just get it. I want to be a composer. And I knew instinctually that the best way to get there was not going to be, for me at least, being an arranger or an orchestrator. Although I did work as an arranger and a musical director, and I played nightclub acts, and I would write songs for Sesame Street, and I'd do anything I could just to make a buck. But I told myself, this is a calling, like the priesthood or whatever. I'm doing this regardless of what the payoff is. I am doing this. And that's what I stuck to, and I just continue to write and write and write because it's what I wanted to do every day.
Early in your career, you weren't necessarily thinking about musical theater, and you were writing pop songs, right?
I was rebelling against it. I grew up actually loving musical theater through my parents and my family, but I thought, no, you know, I'm not going to do that. I would, you know, when I was at NYU, I just filled notebooks full of, you know, these very personal songs, and I did think about, you know, being along the lines of what Elton John or
like Bill a rock Joel star.
Jackson Brown. And I love them. I'm the biggest fan. And I had to have a catalog of songs that are like that, that, you know, I guess I could unearth someday. But I actually found in musical theater that instead of just, you know, going to, I'm going to make a new album and I'm going to pull it, you know, what am I feeling now? Or what am I saying about this love or this situation or what, just simply from my own life, I subjugated that to telling a story, going through characters, to working with collaborators, and it opened up such a treasure trove of styles and opportunities that I never really looked back with any regret. And now, of course, if you look at Broadway, you see so many of these artists were going, I want to write Broadway shows.
Right, everyone's back. It's such a great distinction to think about the emotion that flows through a musician to write personal songs. But the emotion flows through musicians to write emotion, meaning you get this opportunity to write musicals or music that is to capture a moment, to capture an emotion, to be a part of a bigger story that may not be yours.
And yet, I am Seymour. I am Ariel. I am Aladdin. I am any of the characters. I and the lyricists, we channel ourselves through them. And it's rich. It's really rich.
Yeah, I want to take a break here, and when we come back, I want to talk to you about Little Shop of Horrors, because at that point you had started to do some musical work and some off-Broadway stuff, but Little Shop of Horrors is what puts you on the map. Alan Menken, my guest, he is at the Auditorium Theater tomorrow night with his show A Whole New World of Alan Menken, the Disney legend and a tremendous award-winning composer, is in studio tonight here in Extension 720. We'll take a quick break, come back, more of the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Alan Menken is here, the award-winning Disney legend. You have been behind so many projects that mean so much to so many people, whether it be, we're going to talk about Little Shop of Horrors, A Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast. The list goes on and on and on, even to this past weekend. I was watching Wreck-It Ralph with my 11-year-old son, and Alan Menken's name pops up in the credits. But it just shows the depth and the canon of your career. Let's go back to, what was it? It was 19th and 5th in New York City, above a salon of some sort.
Well, it was the Chopsticks Massage Parlor. Was in there. It was above.
Maybe not a salon, a massage parlor.
I never went there. And at the bottom floor, there was a nice coffee shop. And it was a basically, I think you walked up four flights to get to the WPA Theater. But it also was an elevator when it worked.
And what year are we talking about here? This would be 1970s.
Well, I started there in 78 when Howard Ashman and I were working on God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater. And then Little Shop was in 82. First of all, that part of New York became an epicenter, because also one block away was, it was called 890 Broadway, and all the Broadway shows were rehearsing there. And so, ironically, that little
spot,
circle of a few blocks in New York was quite an explosive scene. We had done God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, which was a show that got good reviews, had 14 characters and a little band, and was just too big for off-Broadway. And Howard then calculated for the next show, you know what, we're going to have no more than 9 characters. Well, actually, we had 8 characters and a puppet, you know, the voice of the puppet and the puppeteer. And that would price out with a little band. And first we opened at the WPA, which was a, I think 299 seats. It had to be small enough to qualify for Equity Showcase. I had very intermittent air conditioning. So,
as any good off-Broadway theater has, right?
It's a great space. You know, things just exploded out of there.
But what I love about it, and tell us if this is accurate, it felt like, because there were lines around the corner, everybody wanted to see this show, Little Shop of Horrors. So the Broadway creative community, the sort of elite art community, people wanted to be in the audience to see this, what amounts to a late night musical.
Yeah. In fact, we were going to have midnight shows, and then Equity said, no. But if there's ever a show that would have thrived having a midnight show, it was Little Shop. After we were really a smash at the WPA, then came, you know, a lot of different producers came to make bids on producing it, and there was a push to come to Broadway. And Howard very smartly said, no, this is built for off-Broadway. This is built for a tacky space.
But what it did is it showcased you and Howard's creative DIY spirit in this way that you didn't have to put Little Shop of Horrors necessarily on Broadway, because really it was about two of you being able to create whatever was next.
Yes. And at that time you could run a show off Broadway and I think you'd do pretty well. And even now you can, but it requires a lot of investment. And we had as our producers David Geffen, the Schubert Organization, and Cameron McIntosh. So clearly the plan was, just like Audrey 2, you know, you plant that little seed, little Audrey 2's everywhere. Little Shop of Horrors everywhere. We had, you know, that production out in L.A. at the Westwood Playhouse, and we had the production in London at the Comedy Theater, and we had a tour. And it just, from there, it exploded.
You know, to hear these stories and to hear you talking about this is a lifetime ago. We're talking about the early 80s. Yeah. Do you recall these memories with fondness? Do you look back on these moments? Because we haven't even gotten to the points that have made you uber famous, a Disney legend. This is you as a up-and-coming artist in New York City, off-Broadway.
But this was that moment where I went, you know what? I can make a living doing this, because I was writing my shows and I was also very involved with the jingle scene in New York and club scene. And I was thinking, well, what am I going to do to really make a living? Because I don't know if this theater thing is going to do it. And I remember telling, there was a man named David Lucas, who had Lucas McFall was a big Jingle House, and he kept saying, "Alan, come on, we'll set you up with an office, and we'll set you up with your own studio." And I said, "You know what? I have one. Let me just do this one show, see what happens." And the show, you know, sort of spared me from that, which wouldn't have been terrible, but it wouldn't really have been the life I want. What was great about it is not only was it a successful show, but it was traditional musical theater,
yes,
but with a real rock and roll,
yes,
hip score. And that opened up a lot of different doors. And it was a big moment in my life where I said, wow, we're good. And from there, because of David Geffen being one of our producers, that's how I connect us to Disney. I think David probably whispered in Jeffrey Katzenberg's ear,
right,
and said, this is guy Howard Ashman, especially. Howard then went out to Burbank and met with them and was discussing a number of projects. And I think much to their surprise, the one he wanted to do was Little Mermaid.
And I want to get to the Little Mermaid. You mentioned the hip score of Little Shop of Horrors. And when you think of that musical and you know those songs, they are well known. They are ingrained in our heads. What were you going for? Because there was a rock and roll, but there was a doo-wop kind of vibe to a 50s, 60s vibe to it. Take us through what you were going for
the
score.
First time we were working on Little Shop, we did a score that was kind of true to the Corman movie. It was kind of jazzy and a little bit nerdy and it was hip in its own way, but everyone looked at us like we had three heads or something. It's like, what is this? But then Howard went back, and there's a line. If you look at the old horror movies, those beach blanket horror movies, or if you listen to the Phil Spector apocalyptic songs, Leader of the Pack, that whole sound, it was almost like the end of the world as narrated by rock and roll. So that was the vocabulary that we very much funneled into Little Shop. And it was not just the story of this plant. It was also is the story of the end of the world, so to speak. And it's actually a Faustian tale that has a lot of resonance, for real, but totally in a fun package. And I really credit Howard with the brilliance of that concept. It was so smart. And as soon as we put all those elements together, I knew it was... You just could feel it in your gut. It was exactly the right time for that.
It's amazing, too, because, at that time, you think about what was happening in Broadway. You did have a lot of great shows, memorable shows. I think of all the things that were happening in the 70s and early 80s in Broadway, but not that kind of score, not that kind of rock and roll narrative.
Well, my collaborator and friend, Stephen Schwartz, was coming along with Godspell and Pippin, which was the opening the door. He had, a lot of those pop influences in what he did. The year of Rosewater, I remember, was the year of Sweeney Todd. Even though it's traditional Broadway, there was an edge to that score. It was also the year of Evita. And of course, Jesus Christ Superstar. All those elements were clearly, you could feel them coming to energize theater in general. And Little Shop was very much among that.
Do you believe... Because as you mentioned, that Little Shop really belonged in an off-Broadway four-story walk-up theater, like just to start with that kind of vibe and the way that it was going. Do you believe it would have the same success if it started on Broadway?
No way. On Broadway, if you didn't polish up every aspect of the production and slick it up, I mean, people would go, what am I looking at? Medium is everything. What was it, Marshall McLuhan? Is it the medium is the message? And it is the message. For a musical can be, anytime you're telling a story through music, it's a musical. So Tommy, when it was an album, was a musical.
Right.
Something on television with his songs, that's a musical. Theater is theater. Broadway is Broadway. And now Broadway has evolved to a degree, but when we brought Little Shop to Broadway, how many, 20 years ago now? Gospel, time flies. less than 20 years ago, but not that much. And we did shine it up. It was sort of the shiny toy Little Shop. And audiences loved it, but it wasn't the same thing. Walking into the lobby of a Broadway house with all of the connotations that go along with that are not all that compatible with, Skid Row. And I think, people, it's good, better if they go to Skid Row and see Little Shop of Horrors.
Alan Menken is my guest. He's got a new show that is going to be at the Auditorium tomorrow night, A Whole New World of Alan Menken. He's telling stories, singing songs from his brilliant career. And we'll take a break and we'll get the headlines for the news. When we come back, let's talk about the Disney Renaissance and your role in it. it's just tremendous to, I mean, you are a Disney legend, capital L. This is a real thing, yeah. The Disney legend. Alan Menken, my guest tonight in Extension 720. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Alan Menken, my guest, singer-songwriter, composer, award-winning, 8 Oscars, 11 Grammys, a Tony, Disney legend for his work, really with the Disney Renaissance, which movies like Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, music that is so iconic and so familiar, it is ingrained in American culture. I'd say global culture at this point. And you're at the Auditorium Theater tomorrow night to sing some of these songs, tell these stories, and I really appreciate you taking some time out to talk to us. It's amazing. We stopped the story before the news with Little Shop of Horrors, but to make the transition to Los Angeles, to make the transition into movies, to go to scores and compose songs, is it a difference than working on musical theater like Little Shop of Horrors, or is it the same thing?
Well, it's both. It's the same in terms of when you're writing songs that are going to be telling a story, you have to make choices, stylistic choices that are smart and appropriate to telling that story and to creating a point of view about the story. And when the opportunity came to work on The Little Mermaid at Disney, in many respects, I looked at it as my reunion with Howard and our follow-up to Little Shop of Horrors. You know, this is, sometimes when we refer to Part of Your World, I think Howard or somebody would refer to it as somewhere that's wet. As opposed to somebody that's green. Because it still is that kind of moment where your central character still has a longing and a dream and all that. And we were hired to create animated musicals that could sit on the shelf, comfortably on the shelf, alongside Snow White and Cinderella and Pinocchio and Peter Pan and all those. So what does that take? Well, first of all, the medium itself in animation allows for a certain kind of breaking into song, but it still is very much based on the musical theater of its time. If you go back to Snow White, there's elements of Sigmund Romberg in there, and there's elements of classic, you know, operetta. So we were pulling from a lot of diverse influences, which is also very much Disney, because Disney pictures, whether it's live action or animation,
right,
they really do go to distinctly different stylistic places and geographic places. They're very conscious of that, and they really thrust music forward. So in the case of Little Mermaid, one of the pivotal decisions was, when it was presented to us, John Musker and Ron Clements had this character of Sebastian the Crab, and Sebastian was a stuffy music director in the court, and he was English. And I guess we could have worked with, like, a stuffy English composer, whatever, but it wouldn't have been necessarily all that distinctive. Howard said, how about we make him a Caribbean crab? Now, part of what I think was in Howard's head also was reggae. We really didn't use reggae that... I mean, it's a little bit of...
the steel drum. Kiss the Girl. But
you look at Under the Sea, it's really more calypso.
Right.
But that world of the Caribbean and everything that comes with that opened up a stylistic door, and you have the Sebastian the Crab, and he's very proud, and he's also very scared, and you know, and he's a big fish in a little pond, and we adore him. But being able to, you know, capture that and express it through musical ideas, mm-hmm, it just lit up an audience. And then Ursula going to a sort of a Brecht and Weill kind of German cabaret place. Again, it's just every time you can take people to a place, even if they don't understand what place you're taking them to, they know it's a specific place. And it fascinates them. And that makes all the difference in writing these scores, is they are, in a way, drawing on homage. Homage to each of these little winks that we put in there.
It's really fascinating to think that way, because when The Little Mermaid's a great example, where I may not be familiar with calypso music, I may not be familiar with the German cabaret music you're talking about with Ursula, but I know those songs.
Sure.
And I know that they are iconic songs. I don't need to know German cabaret to know that song. And there is something about music and emotion and who the audience is, everything that circles around the not just the songs in that, but the score, that it is Disney. And it goes beyond, and I'm not trying to just plant in everybody's mind that Disney is your memories, but this idea right, that it does play. You hear those songs and it takes you to a place, and not necessarily Under the Sea, but where you heard Under the Sea.
Yes. Well, there's a couple of things. First, Disney is obviously it's a huge corporate entity. It's many different things. But if you go back to the essence of what Walt Disney was, it's a purity of heart. And in telling these stories where you have a very everyday, common, innocent, central character who has this big dream that's very universal, it has a lot of heart. It's a safe space.
Do you know that going in as a composer? Do you think of that pureness of heart when you're tasked with doing
Little Mermaid? I'll tell you a story. Before I was doing Disney, just before, we had done Little Shop. My daughter was born. We had gotten a farm in Pennsylvania, and I was living out in this farm. It was a beautiful, idyllic location. What could be better in life, except there was this plague called AIDS. It was killing people all around us, in the theater community, in the artistic community. And it was incredibly frightening, because we didn't know, you know, how does it happen? How do you, you know? At the same time, the Disney animated movies, the classics were coming out in VHS, and I would stick them in the machine, I'd hold my daughter on my lap, and I'd put on the news, I'd go, oh, no, I can't watch the news. I'd put on some sitcom, which is making light, but it's not sitting right, I can't watch it. Action Adventure, I couldn't watch it. The Disney movies were a safe space. I felt it. I could watch like a Winnie the Pooh. It's very innocent, but at the same time, sophisticated stuff. And it just was, I felt in my gut, this is a very important refuge. And I think I took that into the part of my career that works at Disney is a sense of that we are creating a safe refuge. And it is sacred, and it's really important. And you screw around with that sensibility at your own peril. Yeah, you know, that's why certain times, you know, with Hunchback, with Frollo, whatever, you push that edge and you know there's nervousness and you have to push that edge. But still, there is that basic core of decency.
The irony of knowing how those Disney films helped you in that moment and to have your creative partner die of AIDS. It's amazing to look back at such a small career and a brilliant career of Howard Ashman, to really just look at, and you have honored that throughout your career, to see how he has had such an impact and didn't live to see it.
No, he didn't.
How do you feel about that? That point that the work that he put forth?
It's one of the most poignant aspects of my life. There's a wonderful new documentary that was actually done by Don Hahn, Don produced Beauty and the Beast and was one of the producers on Hunchback, and also he did The Lion King. But Don is somebody who's very much a legend at Disney. And it's a documentary called Howard. It's going to be available on the new Disney streaming service. Not that I'm trying to promote them or anything, but it's really touching. And it gives you a sense of his brilliance and, yeah, his you know, his flame burnt bright and quickly. And it was tragic. He died before Beauty and the Beast was released. He kept it very secret, even though when you look at the symptoms, we should have known, but, you know, sort of like you block it out. But on the night of the Oscars for Little Mermaid, when we're sitting with our three statuettes, he said, when we get back to back home, we have to have a serious talk. It's, what? Tell me. He said, no, not tonight. No, this is a wonderful night. And when we got back to New York, he told me, you know, he said HIV positive and it was a death sentence. And he just went downhill. And he died 6 months before Beauty was out. And it was a very emotional time. And I think the emotion of the subtext also had some effect on the work that we did. It was just an amazing time.
It also has to be tremendously warm, and the idea that Howard's work lives on. And there are many artists where their work lives on after they die. But this work that you guys put together, it continues to be a part of young fans. I mean, someone having a 2-year-old, 3-year-old singing these songs. And it has to mean something to you that the work lives on this way.
It's huge. It's huge. And there's no experience like sitting in front of a Howard Ashman lyric for the first time. And I miss that immensely. On the same hand, I've had wonderful, wonderful collaborators since. Tim Rice, Stephen Schwartz, David Zippel, Jack Feldman, I worked Newsies with, Glenn Slater, Chad Beglin. Wonderful collaborators, but there's something about Howard that was really unique and just unbelievably brilliant.
Alan, our theme in the show tonight is new versus old versus new, out with the old and with the new is what we're calling it. And I thought about this when preparing for this, just about Broadway and how we kind of talked about you mentioned about, you know, with Hunchback and the idea of what the traditional Disney vibe is. And sometimes you get too close to the edge. And you got to watch for that. As we see Broadway shows want to innovate, want to change the way they interact with audience or just do something new. That's what artists want to do. How much do they have to straddle, and how much do you have to straddle in your work, the tradition, which makes this so amazing, this work, and innovating and trying something new?
Yeah, it's all a balance, and it's all in the gut. There's this thing called the gestalt of the moment, or the zeitgeist, and it is the force of the moment, and something can be perfect of this moment, and you wait 2 years later, and it's not quite the same. I remember when the Chorus Line opened on Broadway. It was phenomenal. At the same time, Chicago opened. And it was like, oh, it's old news. It's old. That's old-fashioned Broadway. Chorus Line was so innovative and new. Who would have thought that 50 years later, Chicago would be still running 12 years on however long it's been. I don't know how long it's been. It's just an endless run on Broadway. And people, a lot of people don't even know about Chorus Line. That's a shame because Chorus Line is incredible. But it's just symptomatic. Look what happened with Newsies. Newsies was a major flop movie. It just and yet over time, people attached to it. And then I won my first Tony Award for Newsies. And the time was right to bring it in. And every, you know, it's like Peter Allen said, everything old is new again.
Yeah.
And all the new shows that are coming in, look, this Temptations musical just opened, Ain't Too Proud. What are people responding to? It's nostalgia for Motown, for that fun. I think that's why the jukebox musicals work. There's a lot of return when you're doing a new wink at an old style, and people pick up on that. That's huge. And that's what we're always doing. You know, there's always looking for the old to bring that flavor back in a new way. That's where new comes from. There's really nothing new under the sun.
Alan Menken, A Whole New World of Alan Menken, is on stage tomorrow night at the Auditorium Theater in downtown, right on Congress, or Ida B. Wells Way now. The award-winning Disney legend, Alan Menken, my guest tonight on Extension 720. Alan, thanks so much for sharing your stories. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This is the song I See the Light from Tangled, which is a movie that came out in 2010. And during the research for Alan Menken, who is at the Auditorium tomorrow night, I saw he was the one who composed the song. And this is a song I remembered watching the movie Tangled when Miles, my son, was young, 2-3 years old. And I was like, this is a perfect song. Listen to this. They come in and sing together.
And it's like the sky is blue, and it's warm and real and bright, and the world has somehow shifted. All at once.
Oh, he's gonna come in here. All right, keep it underneath. But it's amazing to me. If you look at Alan Menken's IMDb page or Wikipedia or anything like that, you will see every song that has been since the early 90s that has any sort of resonance besides Frozen. Everything but Frozen. And I thought about this because this was a song I remember when the movie played, because we're playing the full version, but the movie plays. I remember watching, because, you know, when you watch it with a 2-year-old, they watch for a little bit, then they go do something else, or they're not interested. So you get stuck kind of watching the movie, and I'm like, this is a great, Tangled is a great love story. It's a story of Rapunzel. It's, you know, it's Mandy Moore, I think Joshua Levi, Zachary Levi. But a really great story about and they have this song, and this is towards the end of the movie. And it really is. I remember at the time going, whoever wrote this song, whatever Disney producer wrote this song, I had no idea who Alan Menken was. Whoever wrote this song knows how to write music, because it is a perfect song. When they come together here, it's... That's enough Disney music tonight. What do you think? I'll just go ahead and get rid of it. But go to the auditorium. It's amazing to me. Because I'm not a Disney guy. Like, I'm not a guy who has really found those movies to be resonant. Like, I've never been... I mean, when Little Mermaid came out, I was in my 18 years old. I'm listening to alt rock. I'm not secretly putting on a Little Mermaid soundtrack. But to look as a dad and having to go through the canon of all of these movies, you do see, and beyond just the movies, you notice, because I had gone to Disneyland, and they have all the rides, and they have, in Disneyland, they have two parks. They have the Disneyland, then they have the California Adventure, which is on the other side. And the California Adventure is going to be all the Disney Renaissance stuff, like Little Mermaid. And when you see the power of the music played out in this ride, the focus of the ride, the animatronics, you know, a little crab going, meow, 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 you know, when you go by on this little ride, but it's the music and the feeling that they're evoking. And when you hear Alan talk about the purity of heart in the conversation, what Disney is, they are pushing that hard at the theme song, you know, the Happy Place, and you notice that there is some truth to that, you know, like he talked about that moment with his daughter, and you know, being scared of the world around him, and the one place he could go would be to dive into the VHS tapes of the old Disney movies, and I think there's something to that, and there must be something to it, because these continue to be relevant years after they're made. So it has to be they were able to really dig in into our consciousness in some way, tap into it, that they really do. They have marketed the purity of heart. And Alan Menken has a lot to do with that, because those scores and those songs, just as you just heard right there, Tangled, that's 2010. That is 20 years after The Little Mermaid. So anyway, I'm done. Coming up, we're going to do some more Chicago neighborhood tours here on the program, Extension 720. We're going to go up to Bucktown Wicker Park, corner of North Damon and Milwaukee, which at one point, when Little Mermaid was out, early 90s, was considered the hipster bastion. It was the creative center of Chicago. Not so much anymore in 2019, but we'll talk with Eitan McHaley, who's been living there for 30 years, about how the neighborhood has changed and what issues are front and center before this runoff election in Bucktown Wicker Park, because I don't think they will be the same issues as, say, Chatham or Inglewood or even Jefferson Park. Also, we have a twofer tonight. We'll go to Andersonville. Andersonville, a great neighborhood to talk about the old and the new. A Swedish neighborhood, a lot of Swedish history there. And also a prominent lesbian community, a community that has seen encroaching. There have been several families, both straight and gay, that have moved in and have threatened the lesbian-centered community of Andersonville. So we'll talk, and threaten, that might not be the right word, it just change. And we'll talk with Abby McEnany, our buddy, who is self-professed not to be politically active, but she does a good job in explaining where she lives. So that's coming up here on the Extension 720. Stay with us. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman.
Check
Chicago has always been considered a melting pot, as immigrants from all around the world settled here. German, Irish, Polish, Mexican, the great migration of African Americans from the South. Oh, and don't forget the Swedes. Which brings us to our next spot on our neighborhood tour, Andersonville. Andersonville is a north side neighborhood that's tucked between the lake and, say, Ashland Avenue, bordered by Edgewater to the north and Uptown to the south, Foster Avenue and Clark Street, the main drag. It boasts a strong Swedish-American history, but Chicagoans mostly know this neighborhood as a center for the lesbian community. Women and Children First Bookstore serves as the anchor, but times are changing in this area. The Swedish bakery closed, and more straight and gay families are moving to the more affordable neighborhood. Politically, the ward is a mishmash of north side powerhouses. The 40th, the 46th, and the 47th run pieces of this neighborhood. So who should I talk to about Andersonville? How about my friend, comedian Abby McEnany? Abby has owned her condo south of Foster for years now. She's lived in the neighborhood for over 20 years. Right now, Abby's riding high, coming off her successful showing at Sundance. Her pilot's called Work in Progress. She's the star, and it's produced by Lily Wachowski of The Matrix fame. Abby took me to the coffee shop Collectivo on Clark Street. Good coffee, good sandwiches, and a good convo about a changing neighborhood.
How often are you in this place, Abby?
Actually, it's kind of like a 20-minute walk from my place. I'd say this is like my seventh time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that from where you live, and I guess you call it South Andersonville, is there like a SOA or something like that? NOAA, North and South?
Justin, you know more about this city than I do.
I just think call that there, Anderson- between here and where you live,
there are tons of places.
There are 50 places.
Ooh, I think you're lowballing it. I would say it's closer to 5960, but yeah, I would say, yeah, there's a bunch.
You've been in Andersonville for 20 years.
Yeah, I want to say after college, I moved to Logan Square, which was great. We lived in a 2-flat, me and my roommates, and the rent never went up, and there was nothing there. And I went back a few years ago. Dang, dog, there's a lot going on, man. I was like, wait, people hang out? So I moved up here, I want to say like 2000.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about Clark Street in Andersonville in 2000? What was different? Was it bustling? Because I do remember there's a lot of
bustling,
traffic here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say the first time I really came up here was when I was living in Logan after college and like newly coming out and stuff, and like all the dykes were up here, like, right? And so you'd come up here and I'd be like, wow, look at all the lesbians. And it was just like a great place to hang out, you know? And of course you have the anchor of, to me, the anchor of the community is the Women and Children First Bookstore, which is the most amazing bookstore on the face of the planet.
And still here.
It's amazing.
Independent bookstores have come and gone, but they still remain. Yeah,
it's phenomenal. It's just an amazing bookstore. And so that was always sort of like, I just remember the lingo, like, hey, I'm gonna go to the bookstore. And even if you were down like in Hyde Park or Logan, you knew what the bookstore was. Yeah, so it's much different. I mean, I'd say there are many fewer. Look it up. Whenever I mess up words or grammar, my dad's like, get Hannah on the phone, because Hannah Gray was the president of the UFC when I went there, and he was always outraged. He's like, get Hannah on the phone. Like, I mean, he's been doing that for the...
We'll get her on the phone.
The 80 years since I've graduated.
We'll get her on the phone. We could do that.
Rest in peace. I don't know. I don't know.
You don't know.
Who knows? I'm barely hanging on. Anyways, fewer, like, family-owned things, and, like, it's funny... When Starbucks came in, it was like, oh, you know, it was a chain, right? And then I, unfortunately, do go there.
A lot.
A fair amount. Much less than I used to. Stop shaming me. But then even, like Giordano's came in a few years ago. It has since left, but it was like, that doesn't feel right.
Well, Andersonville has always had two faces. One is Swedish-American, mm-hmm. where they had the History Center here and the bakery that was here for a long time. And then a lesbian community that everyone knows to around Women and Children First, but also some of the businesses here. Yeah. Is it still the same? Is it still known predominantly as a lesbian area and a Swedish area?
I don't know. I've been here for so long, and not quite a shut-in, Justin, but I would say for the several years... There are many more gay men here. There are more straight families. Queer people can have families, too. Everybody chill out. right, my alderman? Still voting. Okay, I'm on a roll. But wait, yeah. More gay men and then more straight families. Younger families. It's a stroller derby.
Is it really?
Weekends. Yeah.
I think about Andersonville, and I remember it being Swedish, but I also remember it being older. Like an older kind of vibe to the houses.
So I finally aged into it.
You aged into it. But now you get this vibe in this neighborhood of a lot of teardowns and new single families. And how is it modernized? How has this neighborhood changed over there?
My area where I live is mostly apartment buildings. And when they're teardowns, a lot of like, I'd say two or three flats got torn down. Yeah. And I don't know, man. The monstrosities they put it, they don't fit. I don't think they fit in with the flow of the neighborhood.
What about businesses? Because I always think about Andersonville, it's, like we said, it's bustling. And we could talk about all the positive things that have happened up and down Clark Street.
Yeah.
Restaurants and otherwise. But I think as well that there's a lot of turnover here. Because I know you and I hung out, I feel like it was 10 years ago at Tees. There's a lot of turnover. There's restaurants that change over here. It seems to be a high-trafficked area, but not a lot of consistency to keep the businesses around.
I think it's the rent has become unaffordable, and probably the taxes. Yeah, I think that is very true. And I go to a wonderful framer here, and, you know, he's a one-man shop, and he's been there forever, and I'm just like, please don't leave. Like, I mean, stuff like that. Like, I just, there's so many home, like, beautiful home things, but there's still a lot of individuality. I don't want to say, like, there's so many, like, individual or like they're non-chain stores. What do you call them?
It's
a beautiful place, but I imagine. I mean, I'm not a business owner. I barely own my shoes. But hold on for a second. And I was actually talking to the lovely framer, and he was saying that like, I was like, "What's your issue?" And he was like, "Well, there's one of those city bike things across from my what is it called here?
Divvy bikes
thing, and that like ruins parking in front of my store." And I was like, wow, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I wouldn't think anything. Yeah. You know, as you being here 20 years, and I know that you consider yourself to be not politically active.
Like, that's
not true. You were so worried about, you're like, oh, don't ask me about politics. I'm not a political person.
I would say I care a lot about politics. I think I'm woefully undereducated in city politics and ward politics.
But
I would say
the difference is between, say, politics and the issues in the place you live.
Right.
So what do you think the issues are here in Andersonville? If you had a chance to sit down with the alderman here or a mayor, you had 3 minutes with the new mayor. What would you say needs to be front and center when it comes to Andersonville?
I worry about the people who are being priced out. I could be seen as part of the problem. I moved in 20 years ago, bought a place about 14 years ago before the bubble. Like, I think I would say that if you look around the faces that you, I mean, where did all the elderly people go? And I mean, you guys,
but you're a homeowner here.
I am, but I don't.
So you don't.
Pay,
I mean,
I pay stuff through my escrow. I don't know what my taxes are.
But okay, so forget about taxes for a second. Like, when you talk about business development, there are issues here that are pertinent and shared across all wards, but I think about the Rainbow Roller Rink turns into a huge
condos,
development and condo. Swedish Bakery, which is right across the street here, was turned into something else.
Right.
There's a lot of progress here, but there's not a lot of honoring the past.
Right, and I would say, like, then we go back to the age-old question, what is progress, Justin? Because some of the stuff, like cell phone stores and stuff. That's not the feel of the old Andersonville. You walk down and you're like, I don't need to go to a cell phone store. I mean, I do. I just don't want it to be on my block, you know? It needs to be somewhere else. Oh, that sounds NIMBY. God, what an arrogant classist. But, you know, it really had a feel.
Yeah.
And like a neighborhoody feel, a family feel, a Swedish feel, a historical feel. That's changed.
Yeah.
However, you know, it's a very queer neighborhood. Like, what do we do about LGBTQ stuff? And I say that citywide, but the fact that I still get, like, called out, like, for going to a women's restroom up in Andersonville, it's like, what? This is like, oh, man. So, I don't know. So, I would say, like, it's just a microcosm. And, like, also, I would imagine out of all the wards in the city, we're doing pretty well. I would define what well is. But, like, we're still struggling, like, education.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, all that school that got shut down and all, like.
They had a school right over here. It's one of the 50 that got closed on the corner.
Yeah. So,
Andersonville, Chicagoans know Andersonville, especially a younger population, to be a lesbian center.
Still?
I think so. I mean, I consider myself young. But does it retain it? It doesn't feel as authentic that it might have felt 20 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess since I've lived here the whole time, you know, I feel very lucky. There are a lot of queers in my neighborhood, and there may be a lot of queers in here. Who knows? Sexual and gender are fluid. But anyways, Yeah, so I, and I, this is a bad analogy, but it's like if you put a frog in and they, you boil them and they die, they don't know. I don't feel I'm dying.
Right.
But I've lived here for so long that there's like, it's been
The thing that I really do notice,
like I do notice that, and I think that a lot of queer women have just moved a little further north to Edgewater.
It's got too expensive down here.
Yeah, and I believe that we may be being priced out by gay men who, on the whole, if you like look it up, make more money than queer women. And I mean, that's
An issue you talk to the mayor about.
Yeah, it doesn't matter about sexuality either. Right, it's a gender thing, right?
Yeah.
But then I think I know some of my queer male friends that moved up here. They were done with Boys Town because Boys Town got too much, and we're getting older, except for Justin. And you kind of want to take away from that, like boom, boom, boom.
Like, would you see yourself staying here? Like, are you Andersonville for life?
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, people always like, hey, Abby, how's your condo? I'm like, more dilapidated than you saw it last time. I mean, like, it's fine. I like it. You know, I'm an actor and a writer, and I don't really work that consistently, so I can't imagine moving. And if I got to move, I want to stay in the area. I love it. It's walkable. There is some sense of community and activism and I would just say maybe it's less or different than it used to be, but there still is that sense of a community. And I love walking, especially in the summer when all the patios are out, and you're walking down, and like on a Sunday afternoon, you know, and there are tons of queers everywhere, like outside at the patios, and you just feel like, whoa, this feels great, and I feel safe here.
Abby McEnany in Andersonville, part of our Chicago neighborhood tour. Coming up, we're going to do Bucktown Wicker Park with Eitan McHaley, who's lived in Bucktown for 30 years. It's Extension 720, WGN. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Our neighborhood tours continue after the news. We're going to Bucktown Wicker Park, Andersonville. Pete, you spent a lot of time in Andersonville. You live in Edgewater, just north of there.
Yeah. Love Andersonville.
My friend Tom, he's listening all the way out in Fort Collins, Colorado. And he texted me. He just said, is Simon still jumping?
Heck yeah. Yeah. Best jukebox in the city.
He's some really good spots. You know, it's funny because you've got Hopleaf, which is just south of Foster there.
Great. That's probably the bar that I go to the most.
And then I remember this would have been 1997, and there was a Serbian bar. It was called Cafe Ashi, and it was like Catalpa, north of Catalpa on Clark Street, and they had a stage in the back, and the playground, which is an improv theater. They started to rent space. Someone must have lived around the corner. That's usually how theaters are found. Someone lives around the corner. and that was the first stage that my comedy troupe Schadenfreude played on. It was in the back. It was like the 5600 block, maybe. I forgot where it was. Mm-hmm. So we played there for maybe 6 months. Then we went on to the Heartland Studio Theater and then moved on from there. But it turned into a place called Stargazers, which was a lesbian dance club. And it was a big prominent spot on Clark Street. It was part of the lesbian community. And now it is Jerry's Deli, which is the famed deli, which is a nice place. You walk in that place, it's tables and the whole thing. But I think it was last year, the year before, I walked in there and I had a trigger moment.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, I do not need one of your fancy sandwiches right now.
You feel good in there?
You're serving food in here? That was my first thought. I was like, but yeah, it has a lot of history. You know, as we talk about the old and the new tonight, there is a lot of history as those places become something else and something else and something else that we were talking about.
We, a couple of years ago, we've boycotted that particular Jerry's.
Uh-oh.
Because a couple of years ago, right around this time, we went to Jerry's. It was one of those like glorious like late March, early April days.
Sure.
You know, where it's like 65.
Like this week.
And Jerry's has a beautiful patio in the back up there. So me and my wife, I'm like, oh, let's go just sit on the back, have a nice beer, and then we can walk home. And so we get out there, we get back there, and they're like, you can't sit back here unless you order food. I have a conniption, of course. I don't want food. I just want the beer.
I'm with you.
But, you know, my wife is enough of a...
First of all, a beer in the city of Chicago is as much as of a meal.
You're right.
So what do you...
I could order a stout.
Especially if you have a couple.
Yeah.
And my wife was like, well, just let's order an appetizer. I'm like, no, we will not have this. I will not stand for this. So then, like, we leave and we, you know, I make a stand and I, like, you know, storm out of there. I'm like, I will not settle for this. And then, you know, we're walking home and I was like, well, like, now we're hungry. Like, why did you, like, we could have just, like, what point were you trying
did
to
did you bring
prove?
Up the food? You're like, I'm a little hungry. Come to think of it, I'm a little hungry.
I don't know what point I was trying to prove. But, yeah. So then we boycotted.
I understand it. I understand.
And then,
it's all principle. Stomach, principle first, stomach second. You can't.
You know what I mean, though? You go to those nice places that have, you know, like, and they put the rules out. I'm like, really?
Yeah.
I get the principle thing, too. I mean, I'll go to a store and I won't pay for the 7-cent bag.
Oh, there you go.
In the city.
Do you carry it out item by item?
Yeah. All right. I'll get vegetables, too. I will walk out of there. I'll spend $24, but I'm like, I am not paying
now,
the 7 cents
Now, do you
for the
use
bag.
Your arms as a bag, or are you putting them in pockets?
No, I use my arms, and I kind of take, like, my coat or my sweater, you know, and I hold it like, you know, like Little House in the Prairie, like how they'd hold the potatoes before they...
Ma, I found that we've got the veggies, Ma.
Totally. So I get the principal thing, Pete.
Yeah, right.
I do. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Would they have a no baggy pants rule in here? Were you wearing baggy pants too? I don't know. I guess I understand. I mean, people maybe are sipping domestics in the back for $3, and people want those tables.
I mean,
I
could see if it was crowded, if it was but there was like three people back there. We weren't taking up a table of somebody that was going to order a $75 meal,
right?
You know, and we're going to be there for 20 minutes.
And to give people an idea, that place is not a place that is going. You're going to rack up a $100 bill. This is a $8 sandwich, $10 sandwich type place, right?
I like apps.
Oh, and you throw some apps in. But what I'm saying is you're walking into a fancy restaurant and sitting down for a $75 meal. Yeah. This is a bill that's going to be $20, $25.
Yeah, great sandwiches.
That's why it's weird to be like, why not just let people drink?
Yeah.
But I guess if they're worried, maybe someone, here's who you should be principled against. Someone before you made them have this law or this rule, right?
Yeah.
Someone was like, you know what? I got an idea. I'm going to order a water and I'm going to sit here.
And just like tan. Right?
And then they're like, you can't just have a water. He's like, well, then I'll have the $2 hams. And so then, so maybe you need to go further, you know, do your finding your roots.
All right.
Oh, yeah. And do that. That's for the, who set the rule for the back patio. All right. More to come here. We're going to go to Bucktown Wicker Park on our neighborhood tour. Coming up next here on Extension 720. Chicago, not as much a city as a string of neighborhoods. And it's the issues of the people who live in those neighborhoods that should be front and center before the runoff. Alas, mudslinging and big ticket items like corruption or who did what in the past is taking center stage. That's why we're getting out into the neighborhoods, touring places like Jefferson Park and Chatham or Beverly and South Shore. Tonight, we head to Damon Avenue to talk Bucktown Wicker Park. If there's one neighborhood that's not crying for economic development, this might be it. The areas in the near northwest side of the city, think Ashland to Western, Division up to Armitage. This used to be considered the creative center of Chicago, with beatniks and artists creating a unique oasis along North Damon and Milwaukee. If you look closely, you could see some of the remnants of that bygone era. Local boutiques now replaced by Banana Republics. And coffee shops are now the Nike store. Politically, this ward is famous. It's the 32nd Ward, a ward once run by the powerful Dan Rostenkowski. But that was back when it was mostly Polish and Latino. Today, the ward is run by a different boss, a progressive boss, Alderman Scott Wagesback. But these changes, the supersized development, it's a good problem to have, right? Maybe. But my friend Eitan McHaley has lived in Bucktown for 30 plus years, so he's seen the changes up close and personal, almost like a lobster in a boiling pot. Eitan is the author of the great book on the legendary newspaper The Defender, and he's been a public housing journalist and advocate for years. He chose the place, the new Roby Hotel, right at North Damon in Milwaukee. It used to be a nondescript office building, a perfect place to gaze out on the famous intersection to talk about the old and the new. How do you see this neighborhood?
Well, it's not the same neighborhood that I moved into when I first came here. It's the people are different, the businesses are different, the feel is different. Yeah. And that's sometimes jarring, sometimes fun, sometimes useful, and sometimes sad. Because the families that I used to hang out with are all gone. The types of families that I used to hang out with in the neighborhood are all gone. It's just a really, it's a completely different place, except it's the same location on the map.
You know, for you to say that, that families have left, there has been a constant swing of gentrification through this area for the last 20 years. I can't even think of who's being replaced now. I would think that the uber rich are coming in.
Yeah, I mean, if you go down into Bucktown and walk down Hoyne Street, you're going to find no end of multi-million dollar homes. I mean, these are places well into the millions, you know? And these are blocks that used to be apartments for working class people. And you'd have a small room, small compartments, not a lot of closet space. You know, it was late 19th century architecture. Now it's a totally different density and everything else. It's a really, it's complicated to talk about because I take advantage of many of the new amenities that are here.
Right.
My kid goes to school in the neighborhood. The school has definitely changed as along with everything else in the neighborhood. I don't want to be hypocritical say like, oh, it's, you know, gentrification is awful, or go the other way and say that gentrification is this wonderful thing, because the reality is that most of the people, as I said a moment ago, that I was with when I came to the neighborhood are not benefiting from those amenities the way that I have. I've been lucky, and I'm also lucky that I have a family that can help me stay here, you know?
Right. This area, you look out the window and you see restaurants and retail places that have replaced restaurant and retail places. This is a very interesting concept. But as the election goes, I know that the alderman here is a very progressive alderman, one of the leads the progressive caucus. Is this a progressive neighborhood in Chicago?
That's a tough term that I try to avoid. Like, I'll throw it around here and there, but depending on the context, you could say progressive, you could say liberal, you could say left, you could say a lot of different things. Let's speak in terms that are more Chicago historical, right? This is a goo-goo neighborhood. This is a good government neighborhood. This is a place where people pay a lot in taxes, especially these days property taxes, and they want to see value for that outlay.
Investment, right.
And most of the time, they're not particularly concerned about the status of public services other than that, other than how much is it costing me. They're not talking about the availability of public housing in this neighborhood. They're not talking about the availability of job training, or really, even in terms of the police department, you know, we'll have complaints in terms of the police aren't deploying enough to stop the occasional carjacking. There was a flurry of carjackings, I think, last year, being committed by one group of people. And once they got arrested,
It stopped.
Right. That's the kind of crime that we have here.
What do residents, your neighbors in Bucktown, Wicker Park, especially with this election cycle, what are they talking? What are the issues that are facing a neighborhood like this?
Well, schools are definitely an issue. Schools are the one area of public services where the wealthy, even anybody but the uber wealthy, meets everyone else, right? Because even upper middle class families in Chicago are still looking to take advantage of the public schools. Upper middle class white families in Chicago on the north side of the city do not want charter schools. They don't like charter schools. They don't see the brand names that they recognize, and they don't think that they're getting quality as a result, right? So that's not popular with them. They're not going to ask for more charters. This is not New York or Washington.
They're just out of the reach of private schools.
That's right. They're not going to send their kids to a Parker or a Latin school or somewhere like that because, frankly, they're too expensive for this demographic. So what they're looking for are quality public schools that they feel that they can comfortably send their kids to. There's code words for that. You can call it a magnet school. You can call it a selective enrollment school. And there's different categories for each of those things. So they're interested in that kind of stuff. And as I said, they're interested really in how to keep the costs of things like property taxes from ballooning.
It is interesting because, yeah, of course, you talk about coded language, and there's a lot of it when you talk about schools in Chicago. And you could make an argument that the CPS as we know it now and the one under this mayor has recognized that the upper middle class, the white families of the north side of Chicago, have a choice to make. And the choice is they may flow to DuPage County, to Lake County, to other places where schools are on the register, they're on the up and up, or he's going to have to make a play to keep them here in Chicago. Do you see it that way?
I think Mayor Emanuel, all across the board, he's leaving, and he's leaving on his own recognizance, right? So we can, it might be gentle to give him a break, but I'm not going to do that. He's been daft. He doesn't understand the city, he doesn't know the city, and he doesn't care about the city. And when it comes to the needs of middle-class families and schools, he did not understand what his predecessor did, which is that you have to keep pace by continuing to add new schools to the roster that upper-middle-class families find acceptable. That's to keep them happy, that you can go into all the different moral judgments about whether that's a good use of resources, whether that's okay, whether you're taking resources from the poor and giving it to other folks. That's all fair. But the reality is that Mayor Daley understood that if he did not continue expanding the rosters of the Northside College Preps, the Lane Techs, the Whitney Youngs, if he didn't keep adding schools that were like that to his portfolio, he was going to lose those upper middle class families. And before he was going to lose them as residents, he was going to lose them as voters.
Right.
So he understood that he had to do that. Mayor Emanuel has done nothing to expand that roster, and the result is that the increasing number of upper middle class families in the city are facing ridiculous levels of competition for those schools that leaves them frustrated and angry and, as I said, jaded about the mayor in office right now. The next mayor is going to have to understand that they're going to either expand the offerings that are there for those families or lose them. And both are choices.
Or would that be the number one thing you, as a resident of this neighborhood, if you had a closed door in the first week with the new mayor, would go after, talking about schools? What do you think the biggest issues are that, if you had a chance to talk to the mayor, are for the community you live in?
Well, I'm the wrong person to talk to as an advocate for this neighborhood, frankly, because, to quote Lori, right, frankly, but because I feel like this neighborhood is doing fine, and there are other parts of the city that need the mayor's attention more immediately, right? Schools on the south side are not, even the best schools on the south side need a lot more attention than what they're getting. I would say the most immediate thing that the city has got to deal with is the depleted, demoralized status of the CPD, which, as someone who has covered on and off police issues for 30-something years, I've never seen the Chicago Police Department in worse shape. I've never seen it less professionally run. I've never seen the officers more confused and vague about what they're even supposed to be doing. I've seen the training fall behind. I've even seen things like the equipment kind of go from adequate to junky. They don't even have the equipment that they need. The new mayor has got to immediately do something to fix the police department, and it starts maybe with the federal consent decree, but that's just the beginning.
I'm fascinated because, you know, it's a city, when you look around, here we are in the Roby Hotel, there's young people everywhere. Everyone's got their laptops up, they're hanging out here, their headphones in, everybody's doing, you walk down North Avenue or Damon, it's all sorts of boutiques, and it is geared towards what I think to be a younger demographic. Is that what you see? Is Chicago a young town? Is there more young people coming to Chicago than, say, when we were younger?
Yes and no. It's more young white people. The city is cool for young white people now, but young black people are leaving. You know, young, ambitious, talented, educated black people are the first to leave, and they're leaving sometimes for the south suburbs, sometimes for nearby areas or nearby cities. They're also going to the south. They're going to places like Atlanta, Texas, places where there's opportunity and better weather, of course, but a more friendly environment for African Americans. Sad to say that, because this city was for so long a destination for African Americans seeking political freedom. right? The ones from the South, we've kind of mythologized the Great Migration, but the reality is they came here looking for political opportunity as much as economic opportunity, and now they're leaving, I have to say, for the same reasons. So this neighborhood reflects also something else, because remember, what's happening here is the boutiques are changing into Urban Outfitters, right?
The Nike Swish on the old Mad Bar, I saw that.
Right, the chef's restaurant, you know, that was doing, you know, Korean tacos is turning into native foods, you know what I mean? Brands are starting to take over. This is starting to look more like Lincoln Park than it is, you know, a kind of edgy neighborhood like
that. Crazy though, think about, because this was the hotbed. This was where independent thought was fostered, and in a way, think about the 90s here. I remember there was a protest on North Avenue because the real world took over a building over here. That's where we were at, where it was just like, you're not taking over our neighborhood. And then you see, you flash, you blink your eyes at 2019, and it's a Nike Swish, and like you said, these brand names that are up and down, and that fight is long gone. That this neighborhood is not what Wicker Park used to mean.
But that fight was, respectfully, was over before the protesters started protesting the real world. Those protesters were the same demographic, the same background, probably grew up next door to the people filming the real world as well as the people living in the real world house, you know? It's all the same folks. The neighborhood was already gone by
that point, right, right.
You know? Or was past the tipping point, right? The Latino families, you know, were already on their way out. And listen, to be fair, American cities are not set up for longevity in terms of who stays in a neighborhood. We're set up, the real estate industry and the whole country is set up to turn this stuff over, over and over again.
One of the issues is the inequality in the city, the haves and the have-nots. We sit here in a perfect example of a city neighborhood that used to be accessible for even people like myself and Pete, who'd come in and get a two-bedroom for moderately priced and hop the blue line to get downtown. That's not an option anymore. This is a different neighborhood. Do you see that, someone who's covered the history of Chicago? Are the patterns the same? Is the haves and the have-nots, is the inequality, is it cyclical, like in the history of this town?
This is a different kind of inequality than what we've had, because the highs are a lot higher. The lows are not necessarily lower than historical moments, but we have to go back to like the Depression to see the kind of homelessness, entrenched homelessness, that we see in the city today. On Ashland Avenue, there's the Night Ministry, the well-known homeless services provider, wants to open a shelter. And you had dozens, maybe hundreds of people coming out to say they don't want this in the neighborhood. It's, to me, ironic, because there have been, in the 30 years since I've lived here, there have been people living under the viaducts on the highway on Armitage, North, and Webster more or less the entire time that I've lived here. And nobody really complains about that except to say, let's get those people out of there. Right. Nobody says, like, well, we got to find them a place to live. We got to get them some services. We got to make them capable of living on their own. Yeah, nobody wants that. They just want them gone. And now people are saying that the Night Ministry is going to be some kind of threat. This is like literally a stone's throw away from where people
are already.
Yeah. So what's different now is that a lot of times it's the same people who have now been homeless for decades. It's the same. I see the same faces of people that have been under those viaducts almost as long as I've lived in this neighborhood. They're getting old along with me. That's a different kind of poverty. It's an insidious kind of poverty, because it's so obvious that we're just, you know, holding back the floodgates of resources from these people because we just don't think they deserve it.
Eitan Mihaly at Roby House, the cafe on the second floor there at Bucktown Wicker Park, right at the corner of North Damon and Milwaukee, talking about his neighborhood that he's lived in for 30 years. What a great neighborhood to talk about on a show where the theme is old versus new. Bucktown Wicker Park. We'll continue this. As we said, we were thinking about wrapping this up before the runoff, but these have been so successful. People have been responsive. More people have reached out. I don't think it's bad for us to continue these conversations, to continue to get out and talk to people in their communities after the election. So we'll continue to do this here on Extension 720. You can count on it. All right, we'll take our last break, come back, and then Pete McMurray and Jane Manzuris here. They're going to be taking over at 10 o'clock here on 720 WGN. It's the weekend. Pete and Jane coming up here as we wrap up Extension 720 for the week. We'll be back on next week. We have a couple of shows. Of course, election night coming up on Tuesday. Extension 720 gets out of the studio. Andre and I will be heading over to the Billy Goat Tavern under Michigan Avenue for our election night returns program, where we will have pundits and politicians and candidates and former candidates and you.
And cheeseburgers.
And cheeseburgers.
No fried chips, no Pepsi Coke. We're going to hang out with Sam and everybody, all our
yeah,
closest friends in the city.
How great is that going to be? It's going to be fun, and it's a great place to usher in a new moment in Chicago politics and Chicago history, really. So we will have that, all the returns for the mayor's race, the treasurer's race, and the 15 runoff aldermanic races. And like I said, we'll have conversation, and we'll have food and drink and fun. So come on down to the Billy Goat Tavern, 430 North Michigan Avenue. Which is right underneath Michigan Avenue. If you haven't been in there, that's the original. That's the one. You want to be in that one.
Oh, yeah.
That's where Mike Royko hung out. That's where you could find John Cass on any given day.
Bob Green.
Rick Kogan.
Yeah, there's a Rick Pearson corner, too, I believe.
There is, yeah. Todd was saying that in the new room where we're going to be broadcasting from, there's a Rick Pearson shrine.
I know. Isn't it wild? And even, you know what? Whatever way it goes, it's going to be a historic night in Chicago history.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. So that'll be on Tuesday night, and then we also got a show Thursday and some other stuff here and there. So lots to do coming up next week. It's a big week for Chicago, so listen to WGN Radio.